Good morning. Welcome to the Fraud Prevention and State Oversight Committee hearing. It is Monday, March 2nd, and I welcome everyone to the committee. We are not going to approve the minutes until we have a quorum. Representative Hudson is on his way, so we will just give it another minute. But in the meantime, I wanted to start by inviting our committee page to introduce herself. Welcome. Appreciate all you are doing in the committee this year, both of you. And so if you want to just introduce yourselves, we'd love to know a little more about you. And welcome.
Hi, everyone. My name is Ben. I'm originally from the Cleveland area, and this is also my first year of teaching.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you both. We really appreciate your work during the session. All right. So we are going to start with our presentation from the Department of Human Services. The subject of the hearing today is non-emergency medical transportation, and I'm happy to welcome James Clark, Inspector General, and John Connolly, Deputy Commissioner, and Ms. Grom to the committee. I want to note for the record and the public that the commissioner, newly fully appointed as full commissioner, is not here. She declined, as did we requested the person responsible for NEMT, Diogo Reese, and he is also not here. So I'm frustrated, as you can tell, that the people who are actually overseeing this program, I know Mr. Connolly also has oversight of it, but the person directly responsible for the program is not here to testify before the committee today. With that, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your opening remarks.
Chair Robbins, Lee Pinto, members of the committee, thank you. And to confirm, I am responsible as Medicaid director for the Medicaid benefit that we're discussing here today. So glad to present to you all and to answer questions, stand for questions afterward. So thank you again for the opportunity to present in front of the committee today on non-emergency medical transportation. I believe this is now the eighth appearance in front of this committee. Access to transportation is essential to all Minnesotans. We need reliable transportation to get to work, school, and to doctor's appointments and other medical services. Without that access, choices are limited. Today, I'm focusing on a program that gives over 100,000 Minnesotans enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs the ability to get to medical appointments for the care that they need. Minnesota's Department of Human Services operates the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Program to connect Minnesotans on Medicaid, known as medical assistance, as well as children on MinnesotaCare, to medically necessary appointments. In 2025, this program served over 250,000 people at a cost of $127 million. Participation in the program has grown by roughly 14% over the past 5 years. And we expect to see a steady increase as Minnesota's population and need increase and as our population continues to age. Non-emergency medical transportation is one of the 14 Medicaid services we have focused on with you as high risk. It's also a program that federal law requires us to operate under the Medicaid program. Right now, we're in the process of inspecting and revalidating each of the providers in this program as well as the others. The 5,800 providers we're reviewing will include almost 2,000 non-emergency medical transportation providers. By the end of May, we will be on site to every one of these providers. Each transportation provider is required to have Special Transportation Services, or STS, certification. The STS certification process is overseen by the Department of Transportation, affectionately known as MnDOT, and includes ensuring compliance with, one, qualifications of drivers and attendants, two, vehicle safety and necessary specialized safety equipment, three, general vehicle maintenance and inspection standards, and four, minimum insurance requirements. NEMT providers are also required to undergo a background check. And with the high-risk designation, that would be a fingerprint background check with that, again, with that designation. There's been a lot of inaccurate and misleading and flat-out wrong information about fraud in this program recently. One prominent social media influencer visited multiple transportation companies he claimed provided non-emergency medical transportation and declared they were fraudulent. However, a review of records shows that businesses they visited received no Medicaid transportation payments, and several were not enrolled as a provider, something that's required to bill for providing Medicaid services. Meanwhile, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison's office has been investigating and prosecuting a fraud case involving four groups of people who made $2.6 million in fraudulent Medicaid claims, overbilling, double billing, and phantom billing for trips. In February, one member of this criminal enterprise pleaded guilty in exchange for testifying against others. NEMT is just a part of the work that we're doing to combat fraud, waste, and abuse. We've implemented an enhanced prepayment review system to catch questionable claims before payment is made, as well as analyzing trends in billing and claims to identify sources of potential fraud. We're also removing inactive providers from our system so the data we produce is cleaner and trends are easier to spot. By June, we will have done on-site visits to revalidate each of the 5,800 Medicaid providers in our remaining 13 high-risk programs. In the report he issued this week, Program Integrity Director Tim O'Malley identified a pattern of benign neglect over the past 50 years that created the condition bad actors have exploited. Governor Walz has released his legislative plan for combating fraud, and I'm looking forward to working with all of you to continue working on this issue. We're in a unique place in that we all agree on the outcome that we're working toward. Even $1 of fraud is too many. We will do all we can to continue reforming our systems to minimize risk and harden them against bad actors. And with that, we'll transition to the slides.
Thank you.
All right, to begin, we'll start with an overview of the NEMT benefit. As I mentioned in the opening remarks, it is a federally required service that Medicaid covers in every state, known as a mandatory benefit in the parlance of the Social Security Act. It provides transportation to medically necessary covered services, so medical necessity must be established for the service to which and from which someone's receiving transportation in the program. It covers seven modes of transportation based on the person's acuity and need. It ranges from personal mileage, so somebody using their own vehicle, to transportation by stretcher. And there are several different gradations between. So that could include volunteer drivers, unassisted drivers, assisted transportation, somebody who needs help getting into and out of vehicles, into and out of facilities in their homes, a ramp or lift equipped vehicle, protected transport for people in mental health crisis, and as I said, the highest level is transport with a stretcher. I should note that the lower levels of acuity are administered by local agencies. The state administers the higher modes 5 through 7, as well as managed care organizations. Notably, this benefit will be carved out of managed care and will be transferred into a single administrator on January 1st, 2027, and an earlier transition to the single administrator will occur on July 1st of this year, 2026, for the fee-for-service program. Prior authorization or approval is required for longer distance rides. That includes rides over 30 miles for primary care, rides over 60 miles for specialty care, and modes requiring assistance or specialty transport like the ones that I mentioned, levels or modes 4 and above, as well as out-of-state transportation for counties and other states that aren't contiguous to Minnesota. Moving on to the next slide, you can see here an overview of the providers and broken down by the fee-for-service side of the program relative to managed care organizations. On the fee-for-service side, we have roughly 550 providers in the program, a bit over 1,100 on the MCO side in 2024. And you can see here the recipients, 40,000 on the fee-for-service side, a little over 214,000 on the MCO side. But you can see the vast majority of people in claims are on the MCO side or within their purview. I'll note in terms of the spending, there were increases in both fee-for-service and MCO. Notably, the fee-for-service increase was in part due to an increase in the rates passed by the legislature between 23 and 24. So that was partially due to utilization, but also a rate increase, again, passed by the legislature. Next slide. Okay, moving on to some provider requirements for the program. So to provide and bill for NEMT services, the provider must be enrolled with Minnesota Healthcare Programs, and that's both the transportation organization or the agency, as well as individual drivers. And enrollment includes looking at things like any certification requirements, checks against federal and state exclusion lists. So if they're excluded from Medicare, for example, they wouldn't be able to enroll in the program. Ownership disclosure, who has an ownership interest and review of that information. Site visits to confirm operational business locations and look at operations. and background studies, and in this case, as a high-risk provider type, that would include a fingerprint background study. I mentioned the MnDOT Special Transportation, or STS, certificate, including vehicle and driver requirements, and then, of course, required documentation for each ride, including origin and destination information on the claim. Next slide. All right. A bit more about provider requirements for billing and payment. Providers are paid with a couple of different components. The first is the base rate per ride, and then depending on the distance, there is a per mile rate component as well that's a part of the calculation of the payment rate. Again, payment is based on the individual's assessed mode of transportation, and that's based on their medical necessity and need for assistance or the type of transportation that's appropriate for them. Modes 1 through 7, some administered by counties and others administered by the state or MCOs. Fee-for-service rates, as I mentioned, are specified in statute. Again, the most recent rate increase, I believe, was in 2023, passed by the legislature. Payments have add-ons or adjustments for transportation in rural areas of the state or due to higher fuel costs. And notably, NEMT providers cannot bill for what's called no-load miles. So that means if there is not a member, a person who is enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs, there is not the ability to bill for the service. And, of course, drivers, if they're waiting to pick somebody up at a facility or at their home, that time is also not reimbursable. And I think with that, I transition over to Inspector General Clark.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Inspector Clark, please state your name for the record.
Good morning, everybody. James Clark, Inspector General at the Department of Human Services. So this slide lists the program integrity actions we have taken over the last year. We have talked about these actions publicly in front of this committee, so I won't go into too much detail now. But I will say that several of these new program integrity actions apply to NEMT services, such as prepayment review of claims, disenrolling inactive providers, revalidation and increased site visits, and an enrollment pause for new providers. Next slide. So the governor's anti-fraud proposals would help to prevent and detect fraud in NEMT and other Medicaid services. The proposals include a pre-enrollment risk assessment. I think this is extremely important. This would allow us to better vet businesses before they enroll. Ideally, we should be assessing risk by looking at businesses' history of performing Medicaid services, their financial stability, and their business plans before allowing them to enroll in our programs. We should not be doing business with people and businesses that pose too great of a risk to the Medicaid program in the state of Minnesota. Discussions of Medicaid fraud typically focus on investigations and prosecutions, but by the time fraud issues get to me or the state or federal prosecutors, money is already gone and it's probably too late. I think any conversation about Medicaid fraud must be focused on keeping unserious businesses and would-be criminals out of our programs in the first place. In order to do that, we need to better vet risk on the front end prior to enrollment. The governor's proposal also contains requests for increased staffing and better technology to detect and prevent fraud through prepayment and post-payment review of billing data. We are responsible for oversight of over $20 billion of spending and 300,000 enrolled Medicaid providers. Given the complexity and scale of the Medicaid program, we need technology solutions that can better spot suspicious trends and red flags, and so that it will inform our investigations. Finally, the proposals also include a requirement for electronic visit verification for NEMT and other services. It'd be very helpful to have an electronic record of a trip that we could then compare to billing. Next slide, please. So this slide shows some of the program integrity efforts that are currently in place for NEMT. So NEMT is classified as a high-risk service. That means we do enhanced background studies and more frequent site visits and enrollment and revalidation. Starting this past January, there is a provider moratorium for NEMT providers in metro counties. This means that no new businesses can enroll in the program in metro counties. NEMT is also subject to prepayment review. This means that Optum is applying data analytics to our NEMT claims and flagging claims for further review. Finally, DHS contracts with a private sector vendor to audit the NEMT program. These audits compare billing information to provider records to see whether providers are actually providing the services they're supposed to be and billing us correctly. Next slide, please. So NEMT spending is largely overseen by managed care organizations. I think this is an important point. Currently 80% of NEMT spending is in managed care. So each managed care organization is required to have dedicated staff to prevent and investigate suspected fraud and refer suspected fraud to law enforcement. So just like the department has an Office of Inspector General, managed care organizations don't have an Office of Inspector General, but they have compliance offices. They have special investigations units that are responsible for investigating, detecting fraud, referring suspected fraud to law enforcement, terminating providers, and issuing other sanctions against providers. Lastly, I'll just say, I think this is important. Deputy Commissioner Connolly said this, but NEMT services are part of our revalidation efforts between now and the end of May. Each enrolled NEMT provider in the state will be subject to an unannounced site visit. In addition to that unannounced site visit, we will be verifying ownership and the credentials of the business to ensure that they are a valid NEMT provider. That's all I have for that slide.
Chair Robbins, we're glad to stand for questions.
I'm sorry?
Oh, we're glad to stand for questions.
Excellent. Before we do that, I just want to, now that we have a quorum, approve the minutes. Vice Chair Anderson, did you have a chance to review the minutes of February 23rd?
I did, Madam Chair, and I move approval.
Thank you. Representative Anderson moves approval of the minutes of February 23rd. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. All right. Thank you for your presentation. I have so many questions. I do not know where to start, but I'm going to try as other people get their thoughts together. I just wanted to confirm a couple things I think you said. Was it 14% was the increase in NEMT services? Was that recipients over the last 5 years? I just want to make sure I know that stat.
So the statistic is an increase. Oh, Chair Robbins, excuse me. Chair Robbins, the increase was 8% in the five fiscal years between 2021 and 2025, and then 44% increased spending over that time period. But notably, there were rate increases from both utilization and from, that increase is due to both utilization increases, so people using the service more, but also rate increases for the service.
So just to clarify, 8% increase in recipients.
Yes.
Or providers?
The number of people using
The service. And how any increase in the providers?
So it looks like I noticed there was a slight drop between 23 and 24. I don't know if I have the number all the way back to 2021.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed in the range on that slide. Maybe you can get back to us with a longer time horizon.
Like sure.
The last 10 years, that would be, in general, I think a 10-year time horizon is more helpful to understand the trend.
We'll note that for follow-up, Chair Robbins.
Thank you. Okay. I have so many questions. So back in 2011, there was an OLA report that highlighted severe problems in this program. You mentioned that we are going to one broker model starting next year, or starting in July, I believe, of this year for fee-for-service. Who is that?
Chair Robbins, we haven't selected the vendor yet. The RFP has closed, and the scoring of the vendors that have participated in the RFP is occurring right now.
So there has been use of a broker in the past in the state. Who is that broker currently?
So my understanding is that one of the brokers that we are using is MTM.
And are they applying in this current round?
I believe, Chair Robbins, the answer is yes.
Okay. So this is of concern to me because when back in 2011 the report came out by the OLA, they talked about savings from the broker. There were some positive things. But at the same time that this broker was selected in Minnesota, back in 2004, this same broker was under and did an out-of-court settlement with allegations of fraud in Missouri for the very same things that we are seeing in this program. So they were, according to the court settlement in Missouri, MTM overstated the number of legs involved in gas mileage reimbursements, was paid for third-party vendor trips that did not occur, and received payment from the state in excess of what it was allowed to contract. And the OLA report from 2011 said that very same thing. They got more payments than they were allowed to contract for, and they got an inappropriate cost of living adjustment. So in real time, when you were using them, they were under court orders to stop for fraud in Missouri. So why have they continued to be used in this state? And why are they allowed to apply to be the broker again?
Chair Robbins, I think we will use the totality of the information that we have to select a vendor and appreciate you reviewing some of the issues with the vendor. I think more primarily our experience with MTM here in Minnesota would inform kind of our decision about whether or not to have them as a vendor within the state. Certainly, if there is concerning information about the vendor that is actionable, we would want to know that and take appropriate corrective action to ensure, again, the integrity of the program and billing on their part.
So were you aware of what I just told you?
I personally was not aware, Chair Robbins.
So I don't know what actions you're taking to vet these people, but this was a Google search. So we expect more from the department in making sure that the brokers, the vendors, everyone is well vetted. And I hope you will take that seriously. I have more questions, but I'll let someone else go. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The slide 10 jumped out at me, the managed care oversight of the program. And I don't know if any of you know this, but do you know where that comes from? Is that a statutory, is that established in statute? Was that an agency policy to have to outsource oversight of the program to MCOs? Anybody happen to know?
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, yes. The role of managed care plans is dictated in statute.
Okay. And if I may, yeah. Madam Chair, thank you. So that might be something for us to look at then. I mean, we've had conversations within our committee about the problems that occur when we take public services and we outsource them to private entities. That happens all over, and we know that the, so much of the fraud, well, the fraud that we've been discussing has been in private providers, public funding going to private providers to provide public services. That's concerning enough. We should have conversations about that. But when we choose to outsource the oversight to private entities as well, I think that's particularly problematic. Obviously, the agency is just doing what the legislature tells them to do in this case. So we really, in our case, should be looking into whether we would want to be outsourcing oversight over public programs to private entities, as then you've got multiple layers of privatization at that point, and may well make sense to bring that back in-house. So that's something we should be looking at. I did have a process question, Madam Chair, for you.
Yes.
You referenced earlier about the commissioner not being here. I noticed that nearly half of our committee meetings DHS has presented, and every other meeting the commissioner has been here. Was there a particular reason that this meeting particularly concerned you for the commissioner being absent, since she's been here for all the other ones?
I thought it was just interesting now that she's been officially named commissioner that she chose not to attend in her first official capacity as commissioner.
And maybe, Madam Chair, that maybe in that role she actually has even more responsibilities. She's certainly been here the other time. So anyway, thanks to all of you, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I just want to invite the testifiers who are listed to join us. We'll start with Mr. Stahlberger and then Mr. Prisbilla, who I believe is online. But please don't go anywhere. We have more questions for you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Stahlberger, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs at MTM. We do operate in the state of Minnesota with 18 counties here in Minnesota. And I'll just address the question you talked about earlier. The contract dispute in Missouri was about 15 years ago. This benefit has evolved quite a bit in numerous states. We are currently the contract vendor in Missouri and in 45 other states, and work with a lot of MCOs and states across the country. So the contract dispute was about the basically what was in the contract versus what we were getting paid for. So it was, again, about 15 years ago, and I think since then we've all states have gotten better at looking at what their NEMT process looks like.
Thank you for that. I would just like to point out that at the same time, Minnesota was in the same place with our OLA report saying that you were overpaid and that you got inappropriate cost of living adjustments. So the issues you were having in Missouri, you also had here in Minnesota at the exact same time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The OLA report in 2011 covered all of NEMT services, not just MTM. That include managed care. And the, I think it was $1.8 million had to go back to the state. Believe most of that came from managed care contracts, not MTM. But the OLA report covered all of NEMT services.
Yes. All right, please proceed with your testimony.
Sure. And I'm going to, given the previous overview and your questions, I'll probably skip a lot of my prepared remarks and just highlight that after 2004, the state of Minnesota was actually barred from working with any vendor to coordinate transportation services. Actually, Governor Plenty hired us back in 2004, and to coordinate the entire state of Minnesota, a number of transportation providers were not okay with regulations, and so the state legislature actually passed a law that said the state of Minnesota could not coordinate rides across all of NEMT. That has now changed as of last session, and we are now moving to a full broker model. Yes, we are applying and did apply for this RFP. And I think if you talk to the 18 counties we work with here in Minnesota, and that is just the fee-for-service population, as the Medicaid director indicated, a majority of the rides happening within Minnesota, within NEMT, happen in the managed care space, of which we do not have a contract with either of the three or four MCOs. We did have a contract with United Healthcare prior to them not being allowed to service Medicaid here in Minnesota. So we've been in Minnesota since 2003. Our processes are, as you heard earlier, similar to the state of Minnesota. We do provide on-site regulations for our transportation providers. We work with about 35 companies in the state. And again, we're in the 12-county metro area, and then the other county consortium is in northeastern Minnesota. So those 18 counties are just fee-for-service, and we do about half a million trips, coordinate half a million trips with those 35 transportation provider companies in the state of Minnesota. We do on-site visits and make sure that drivers have a disclosure of ownership, proof of insurance, background checks, UMPI, which is the unique Minnesota provider identifier. We basically make sure that those companies are who they say they are and they're actually doing Medicaid rides. In addition, we actually do trip verification where we call the facility itself and basically make sure that, you know, say Mrs. Jones orders a ride, that they're actually going to their appointment. Like I said, we do random on-site observations at medical facilities and hospitals to make sure all providers are credentialed, is accurate and up to date. They are unannounced audits, provided an additional layer of protection to our annual credentialing process. Anytime we receive a complaint from somebody on Medicaid or from a transportation provider, we do have a process internally to vet those processes to make sure that there is no fraud happening. If we suspect there is, we do turn that over to the OIG, Attorney General's Office, or whatever state entity is looking at those. Again, we're in 45 states across the country, and this is probably one of the hardest benefits within Medicaid to understand. And again, as previously noted, there's a lot of misinformation. It's confusing. Medicaid is confusing. The NMT benefit is also extremely confusing. Transportation providers that we work with are simply trying to do their job in providing rides to and from appointments for medical, people on Medicaid. Prior to this year, rates for fee-for-service were put in statute. And those rates oftentimes weren't even increased for 5 years. And so we were not allowed to pay providers maybe even the going rate. Whereas in a managed care contract, when they're based on a PMPM, they probably have a little more flexibility in paying more. For example, CMS does encourage states to use a broker model, and it's become one of the best standards to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse, and detecting it as well. Having said that, there are a lot of transportation providers out there that maybe aren't even in Medicaid. Again, as the Medicaid director talked about, there are such things as social determinants of health, social services contracts, that some of these providers do work with other county governments. They may not be working with us, or the MCOs might be doing something completely different. So we believe there is room for improvement here in Minnesota. We're happy to see that DHS has taken the authority to finally coordinate statewide NEMT services across the entire state with one uniform set of rules. If you think about our current process, prior to July 1 of this year, basically when the state precluded that DHS could not coordinate rides, every 87 counties had to do it themselves. And so even though we work with 18 counties here in Minnesota, we have another 20 or 30 that are banging on our door saying, we can't do this, we need help. So there's kind of two, almost three models, if you will. There is fee-for-service population, and then there's the managed care. So you have three or four entities doing their own rides, and you have the county-based purchasers. Everybody does it kind of their own way, and so you have multiple ways for providers, transportation providers, to work with one of the five or six entities. Sometimes they have different rules in place. Having said that, knowing my 2 minutes is probably up, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, yeah. Representative Elkins, I do want to get just for, all the testifiers through, and then we can ask more questions. Oh, yes, but I will.
This is real quick. Who would you consider your largest competitors to be? Are there several competitors in your space?
Madam Chair, Senator, we do have numerous competitors in our space. The largest competitor in the United States filed for Chapter 11 this year. They are coming out of reorganization. We are probably the second largest in the country. From there are three or four other handful companies that do try to coordinate rides. As I said earlier, it's a tough business, and we'll always get new entrants into the market that either get gobbled up by another company or frankly can't make it because it's a tough business. So there are also regional players as well that do end up competing in this business.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, next, Mr. Prisbilla, if I'm saying that correctly, I believe you're online.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chair Robbins.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
My name is James Prisbilla. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Prime West Health. Thank you for having me today. I'm joined by Sandra Adams, who will introduce herself here in just a moment. Prime West Health is a county-based purchasing health plan that serves approximately 75,000 individuals residing in the 24 counties that own and govern Prime West Health. Non-emergency medical transportation, because we're rural, is a critical service for our members because there are great distances to travel and a lot of people without the means to get to those healthcare services that require a great deal of travel. We've had experience and have been victimized, but I've also been working a lot on combating fraud in the NEMT space. And I'll turn that over for that discussion to Sandra Adams. Sandy, if you'd introduce yourself.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Adams. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sandy Adams, and I'm the compliance officer for Prime West Health. And I'm here to talk a little bit about a recent fraud experience that we've had with NEMT. Through our compliance and monitoring processes, we uncovered a suspected fraud scheme involving certain NEMT providers. We identified instances where members were reportedly offered kickbacks from drivers. Members were encouraged to travel to more distant methadone clinics, including from northern Minnesota to the Twin Cities metropolitan area, in exchange for higher kickback payments. Drivers were recruiting members to utilize specific treatment centers, and they would coach the members on how to answer assessment questions so that they could qualify for these services. NEMT agencies financially incentivize drivers to recruit and transport as many members as possible in a single vehicle so they could bill mileage for each person in that vehicle. Members were also encouraged to request specific transportation companies involved in the scheme when scheduling rides. We further identified instances where Medicaid members enrolled in other health plans were encouraged to change their enrollment to Prime West Health so that they could participate in the scheme for kickbacks. We discovered these concerns through hotline calls, an anonymous mandated reporter letter, claims data analysis, and interviews with providers and members. Upon identifying these concerns, we suspended payments to the involved providers and referred our findings to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Minnesota Department of Human Services Program Integrity Office. Based on our experience, certain structural features of the NEMT benefit create vulnerabilities, such as agencies and drivers must meet MnDOT requirements, then they can enroll as providers with MHCP. MnDOT handles transportation compliance, and MHCP handles Medicaid enrollment and claims payment, which may lead to a fragmented system. For example, red flags that are not part of standard license checks, such as multiple drivers being associated with the same home address, which was common in the suspected fraud we uncovered. The second thing is that there's limited visibility into the number of riders transported in a single vehicle while mileage is billed separately. Third, non-emergency medical claims are often paid before the related medical service claim is submitted. And finally, methadone treatment is a direct access service, meaning plans cannot require prior authorization, and members may seek services at any location. We remain committed to program integrity, collaboration with state and federal partners, and ensuring that members receive appropriate and necessary services. And with that, I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Adams. Since you're on the line, I think we will take questions for you so that I think that might be more helpful. So my first question is, when you reported your concerns to DHS and the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, what response did you get?
They accepted our referral. So they notified us that they had accepted our referral.
Did they do anything else besides say they got it?
Certainly they vetted the case. We received news from the AG system that they were presenting it to the director at the AG's office, and then they confirmed that they were going to investigate the case.
And how long ago was that referral?
That referral was in November of 2024.
Okay, thank you. And is that the first time you've referred to them, or have you had a history of referring to them?
There have been other referrals to the AG's office and DHS-PIO.
So over how many years have you been seeing this problem?
I'm new as the compliance officer at Prime West Health since October of 2022. Jim, maybe you can...
Well, I think the question, if you're talking about NEMT, that's more recent, the things that we've discovered in terms of in totality, whether it be PCA-related or other home and community-based services, that goes back many, many years. I've been with Prime West for 25 years as CEO, and it's been mostly in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years. We definitely have seen an uptick, but there's been more attention at the national and state level in terms of fraud, waste, and abuse, and the regulatory changes that go along with better prevention and intervention in those areas. So I think we've seen heightened increase in awareness by plans, by Prime West, and sending more referrals to the state.
Thank you. All right. So I don't know if you can stay on, but people might have additional questions later. I'm going to move on to Mike Widener. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Committee members, Michael Widener. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Paratransit Providers Association. I've been involved in transportation industry for over 40 years, and I've been as the Director of the MPPA for 25 years. We've been during that time, we've advocated for best practices and fraud prevention in the NEMT industry. I want to thank this committee for having these hearings. When this committee held its first hearing in February of 2025, the Department of Human Services was reporting that the number of individual rides in the NEMT industry was about 567,000 rides. I've submitted in my presentation a packet of 3 pages. The first page is it shows the rides that were provided. This is from the DHS recent RFP. So DHS reported that at the end of last year, the number of rides, the actual number of rides per month, had been reduced by over 350,000 rides. It went down from 567,000 rides to 215. That's a 62% reduction in rides. Where did they go? They just vanished. They weren't picked up by any other non-emergency medical transportation department. There's the second page is also from the DHS report, and it provides the numbers, the dollars that were spent on claims in NEMT. And in what I've presented to you, there's a blue box which represents $13 million. That was the expenditures for the ride, the pickup. And then there's $20 million in the red box, which represents the number of miles. Those two parts of NEMT were reduced by over $20 million just by this department and shining the light on fraud in the non-emergency transportation industry. Fraud is not new to NEMT. What is new is DHS's complete lack of any attempt or desire to curb fraud. This DHS apathy is disgusting. The lack of ambition at DHS occurred when it started when DHS introduced a broker into the NEMT program. That broker was eventually removed from contracting directly with DHS through state legislation, and that legislation was removed last year. Since I've been active in the industry, we've worked to try to reduce fraud. One of the things we did is we introduced what's called the chain of custody document. Think of it like a FedEx delivery package. When we would deliver, what we had for 1 year before the broker came is when you delivered an individual to a medical provider, the medical provider signed for receiving that person. In just doing that chain of custody, in the fiscal year 2024, it saved over $5 million from the year before. The chain of custody requirement was removed when DHS started contracting with the broker. In 2009, I filed a whistleblower claim with the U.S. attorney regarding the NEMT broker under the False Claims Act. The U.S. attorney investigated this matter and informed me, yes, the NEMT broker had billed for services not rendered. However, DHS was fully aware of that overbilling, and DHS had consented to the billing. So therefore, it was not considered a fraudulent billing under the False Claims Act. The third page of my presentation. What you're seeing on the top section is an electronic record of somebody's a transportation trip provided by a medical transportation provider. This trip dates back to 2015, June 3rd, 2015. This is the solution, my friends, using technology, using GPS, using cameras. What it does is it provides an electronic record of every trip that the car did, and it also provides the number of passengers in the vehicle. So you know if there's six people in that vehicle or if there's one. What the woman had talked about just before me about the fraud and about the activities, those have been going on forever. I mean, we've tried to work with DHS. I went to DHS since at least 2015 and said, require GPS require cameras. And DHS's answer to me was, how much is it, Mike? I said, it's $30 per vehicle per month. And DHS told me that that was too much to expect an NEMT driver to have to pay. And I question that. And when you look at it today, Lyft and Uber require GPS. School buses and protected transportation require GPS and cameras. GPS is nothing new. It's cheap. It stops the fraud. I'm going to end with sort of my last interaction with DHS. I had a citizen come to me, and he was appalled. He came to me because his 26-year-old drug addict, unemployed son told him over Thanksgiving that the son was, Dad, I'm a welfarepreneur. And the dad said, welfarepreneur? He said, yeah. What I do is when I was at the methadone clinic in St. Paul, a recruiter came up to me. And he said, hey, where do you live? I told him I live in South Minneapolis. And then he said, do you know anybody who lives farther away from your address but still in Hennepin County? And he said, yeah. Dad, I told them about your address. So what they did, the recruiter told them, if you go to this specific company and ride with them, they will pay you $25 a day. So the son went to the new provider, and there he received $25 a day, $125 a week. Now that transportation company billed an extra 63 miles for that trip. That's a $75 charge. So the transportation company was pocketing the $75. I went to DHS and I said, all right, I got something for you. I've got the individual, the rider. I have the company. I have the names or the dates that this transportation had. And I thought surely DHS would do something to stop this fraud from continuing, and they would prosecute this company. Instead, DHS explained to me that they were well aware of the problem, and they were working with a broker to fix the problem by limiting methadone passenger use of a specific NEMT company to 30 days. I told DHS, this isn't going to fix the problem. What's going to happen is the passenger will just require the next NEMT company to play the same game. Again, I suggested using GPS and cameras. DHS told me, now, Mike, we got it all figured out. We're working with our broker, and this is going to fix the problem.
Please try to wrap it up. Thank you.
Okay. I mean, this program integrity, this needs to be fixed. But what you can see is what this department is, or this committee has already done, has already resulted in a 62% decline in NEMT rides. It's sad to say it, but it seems like there's at least 62% of the rides are fraud. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for this witness or other witnesses in general? Representative Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I would have a question for DHS about this. If they could confirm.
Please return to the testifier table.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is I want to hear your thoughts on the camera because that seems like a no-brainer. Everyone else does it. And the other is when you look at, is this information accurate that the trips have gone down dramatically since the summer and especially in the last couple months since this has been, you know, put into the fraud bucket of 14 programs. Thank you.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, can you repeat the first part of your question? I think I missed the last word there.
Thank you. I want your opinion, DHS's opinion about requiring cameras like every other, and Lyft, Uber, school buses, everything else, requiring cameras so that we could actually verify that there's a person in the car, where they're going, how many people in the car. So thank you.
And I'll just add also the GPS tracking with the cameras. Mm-hmm.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, I think both with respect to the cameras and to the GPS technology, we would, certainly don't have opposition to those ideas. I think it's a matter of understanding from the providers, again, the cost. And if that's something that, again, I think is an effective deterrent or device that we can kind of process with the providers as a possible next step in terms of enhancing program integrity, I think that's something we're open to conversation with and, of course, would work with legislators on as well. I think with respect to a couple of other items in the latter part of your question, the claims from the last calendar year have not fully run out yet. So we are aware of the decline in rides that is in the graphic provided here today, but also in our own claims data. And we can't confidently state yet that there has been, in fact, a clear decline in rides because providers do have a year to bill. So it's unclear whether or not there's been any decline in rides or billing, as there are several months left for providers to bill from calendar year 2025. I'll note on the opioid treatment program rides, we do also have a policy in place that randomizes NEMT providers or drivers' rides with respect to opioid treatment program services, given the more sustained nature of that service.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Svalb. So it's March 2nd, so now we're several months past the end of 25. So historically, how many claims have come in months after the service was actually provided, historically, in this program?
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson, again, they have providers have up to a year to bill, so we do have usually claims run out for several months into if we're talking about the last quarter of the prior calendar year into the next year. So it could be multiple months from now before we receive claims from the final quarter of last year.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. So historically, what percent of claims come in months later? Not whether there's one or two or there could be one legally, but what is the reality historically? Because I would be,
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Anderson. So I'd have to go back and look at the data in our records with respect to this particular benefit. It can vary by the provider type. I don't know it off the top of my head, but I know that, for example, after certain benefits have ended, you might see in the first several months after the benefit ends an 80% reduction, for example, in claims that are submitted, but still 20% coming in of the volume you saw in the prior year, just to give an example of the tail of claim submission that you might see. But I don't know if 20% is something that we'd apply to this particular benefit. I'd have to go back and look at claims history.
Last thing, Vice Chair.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's really important that you look historically and that we not wait for another 6 or 8 months to go, oh, yeah, it is 62% drop. Because this is a big deal. I mean, 62% drop when we're actually starting, we haven't even implemented really fraud prevention or very little, but we've actually been talking about it. So we're scaring off the fraudsters, essentially. And so I think that's important. Otherwise, the 62% figure is probably the figure that people are going to start using, that we've had a 62% drop year over year in rides since this was put on the high-risk list. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is infuriating. It's beyond infuriating, and I don't even have any questions because, frankly, I'm sick and tired of hearing excuses. So let's compare two things here. We're looking here at this chart that shows, as has been discussed, a 62% drop in the number of rides, and you can see that it starts to fall off in April of last year. And the speculative claim is that, well, people are taking their time to bill. Oh, okay. Can't afford $30 a month per vehicle to have cameras and GPS. Margin just doesn't make it possible. But I can wait 6 months to bill the state for my services. That makes a lot of sense. We're talking about beyond close to 400,000 rides not yet billed for in 2025? That's what we're supposed to believe? The absurdity, and it's an insult to Minnesota's collective intelligence to accept that premise. And I, for one, am not going to submit to it. Let's get to the heart of what this is. This is an incentive problem. Mm-hmm. And I so much appreciate, over the course of these hearings that we've had, the input from the other side of the table, that the real issue here may be that we're outsourcing public services to private companies. Now, there may be some ideological disagreement as to exactly why that doesn't work, but I think that is the heart of the matter, is that we have an incentive problem here. When I order an Uber ride, I'm not going to make a deal with the driver to go further away or charge for being further away than I actually need to go, because who has to pay that bill? I do, right? So the incentive for me is to get the best service at the lowest cost. The incentive for the driver is to provide the highest quality service. Those incentives have disappeared from this process, not just in this program, but in the many programs that we've examined over the course of this committee being a thing. That's the heart of it. So, you know, having oversight, having cameras, GPS, that's great. The real issue here is that we've created a situation, we've created an incentive for people to figure out ways to make more money by providing less. And there's nobody on the other side of that transaction, should be the agency, should be the taxpayer, there's nobody on the other side of that transaction to incentivize in the other direction of saying, charge me as little as possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Hudson. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we expand the electronic visit verification program into EMT, will that help solve this? Which problems that we're talking about this morning would that solve?
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins, thank you for the question. So that is included in the governor's package with respect to anti-fraud measures, and it would speak to some of the issues here that are being talked about with cameras or GPS, and that EVV does have, again, a start time, an end time, and location, start location, the person providing the service, the person receiving the service, the type of service provided. So it is speaking to a number of the elements that have been raised here today, and it is a part of the governor's anti-fraud package.
Okay. Second question, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Elkins.
We've been talking off and on throughout the course of these about the role of MCOs in these various frauds. And on slide 10 today, I'll just read the one paragraph. It talks about EMT site visits and investigations. Each MCO is required to have a special investigations unit, and each MCO crafts their fraud, waste, and abuse detection and prevention practices within the scope of their contracts with DHS. So my understanding is that the MCO special investigation units report suspected fraud to DHS. What are we seeing in those reports? What is the magnitude of the fraud that the MCOs are reporting to DHS? That's probably a question for Mr. Clark, I'm guessing.
Mr. Clark.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins, thanks for your question. So the fraud being reported by MCOs for NEMT is similar to what the folks from Prime West testified to. Mm-hmm. So phantom billing, you know, billing us for a trip when there is no corresponding medical appointment, billing us for excess mileage, kickbacks, I think are an issue in the NEMT program. In terms of referrals, I believe we only had 11 referrals from managed care organizations in 2025. So in terms of total numbers of referrals, it's not that big, but the issues that they are referring are very serious.
In those categories. And do the MCOs pass those costs on to you, or are they basically eating the expenses from fraud out of their capitated payments?
Mr. Clark.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins,
Mr. Conley.
Deputy Commissioner Conley, do you know more about MCO finances? Otherwise, we would have to get. I would have to get back to you.
Yeah, part of the reason for capitated payments, Madam Chair, is that to buffer ourselves against these kinds of things. And I know that I've seen data for 2024 that the MCOs basically lost their butts on Medicaid. So if there's
Mr. Conley,
huge fraud in their programs, that could be part of it.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins, thanks for the question. So with respect to how the managed care organization's capitation rates function relative to fraudulent activity, so they would, in fact, eat the cost, so to speak, during that year, that contract year. Yep. However, unless the fraud is detected, that utilization would be used to calculate, those claims would be used to calculate managed care rates in the following year. So when we work with our actuaries to increase rates as appropriate based on utilization or rate increases from the legislature, that information, if it's not detected, would then inform the next year's rates.
Yes, Representative.
To the extent that it is detected and reported to Mr. Clark's office, would that reduce those rates somewhat? I assume that if you have the data, you're not the next year's rates are not going to include that the amount that was reported as fraud.
Mr. Conley. Mm-hmm.
Chair Robbins, Representative Elkins, sorry, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So I appreciate the question. I know, Representative Greenman, I'm going to get to you in 1 second, but I had a follow-up question related to that. So UCARE has gone under, and I wonder what data you have on how many of their claims in their system were fraudulent, because several of the cases we've seen from Pit Stop and the case involving the fraudster up in Anoka, they were UCARE fraud claims for NEMT, and we're forgetting the web here, but it's usually a web of the provider being fraudulent, the NEMT provider, and the interpretive services, and then the service provider who's providing the therapy or the naloxone or whatever. So it's a triple bill of fraud in most of these cases. And UCARE seems to have had an inordinate number of those cases. So could you comment on how much of UCARE's demise was attributable to fraud?
Chair Robbins, that is a very complicated question to answer. Certainly all of the plans have fraud. All state Medicaid programs have fraud that they grapple with. So I don't know that I can summarize the contribution of fraudulent billing to UCARE's outcome, so to speak, in terms of them kind of ceasing to exist as a health plan. And there were other lines of business like Medicare, like the health insurance exchange Minsure plans that they were involved in or offered. So there are just many, many elements to the evolution of that plan and the ending of that plan. So it's hard to answer, but certainly we do have data with respect to fraudulent claims that were reported to us.
Great. I would like you to send that to me. I'd like to know what percentage of UCARE's business, was caught up in different fraud schemes, not only in these service lines, but in others. Okay. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very rarely will you hear me say that I agree with Representative Hudson. But I do think after a year of being in this committee, what we have seen is the way we have set up these systems, the incentive structures that are in them, the fragmentation. I heard brokers and MCOs, states and county, the state. And in many cases, this is a failed federal and state project of how the feds have set this up, requiring a benefit that then we have set up a statutory scheme that involves a multitude of providers. We have outsourced the oversight in some cases to MCOs or to brokers, and we have different folks doing the vetting from the overseeing and administering from the payment. And so just on, before you even get to people, to the providers, you've created a system where it's a leaky bucket and very, very hard to oversee. And so the question we're asking now is, in some cases, how do we, and we've done a lot, how do we plug and add overseeing? And I want to get to cameras in a second. But to me, the question, if we're serious about this for the long term, which we should be, because people need to get to their appointments. And as we talk about people getting to their appointments, we're talking about some people just need a ride, but other people are going to be on a stretcher. And that's why the Medicaid program has said this is a critical service, which it is. We need to ensure that people are getting there safely and that we are paying for it and overseeing it and doing it in a way that makes sense. And I think we're not going to get there until we look back and say, how do we actually design this program differently so that it doesn't have at least four different places where there can be a target for billing, for all the, you know, overbilling all the way to providing billing for services you're not providing. And I think that this is the thing when we just have a conversation about GPS and cameras, and I want to get back to Uber and Lyft actually don't require cameras in their cars because, and they told the this came out in litigation, if they do, they're worried about misclassification because they have so much control over their drivers, so they chose not to. It matters in that context because it's a way to prevent sexual assault in cars, which is currently being litigated across the country. But what it matters here is it's about incentive structures. For sure, we should have GPS and cameras in the cars. But the best way to do what we want to do is actually step back and say, what's the most efficient way to provide this service that is not just adding more cameras in cars and more people, presumably at the state, to watch the videos of the cameras in the cars? I don't know if we would have a misclassification problem or if they should just be state or county employees, but it does bring me to this question, which is when we talk about the incentive structures and the business model, it seems to me we need to get better at thinking about how publicly required services can be publicly provided, and we should not add all of these private incentive structures in. I'm wondering, one, if there are other states who are thinking and doing that with this, either in pilot program or in actual, you know, their system to scale, actually providing these services in a way that cuts out the brokers and the MCOs and the private providers and actually creates an incentive structure to say, we should pay for this service because we know what it costs. We know how much it costs to pay someone. We know how much the gas costs. We can put a camera in their car and ensure that. Is there any state in the country that is doing that? Is my first question.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Greenman, that's a good question. So Connecticut is an example of a state that has a single kind of administrator broadly and not an MCO overseeing the benefits or processing claims, things of that nature with respect to its program. And it is solely fee-for-service in terms of the way that providers are paid and the way that the administrator operates the program. But they still do have a vendor doing that work for them to process the claims. It's not just state staff who are doing that work. So I'd have to go and kind of check with my colleagues in other states, and we have ways of doing that. We do it regularly. Can certainly answer the question for you to see if other states are purely directly operating an NEMT program with their own staff, but it's likely rare.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you. And I'm actually asking a different question because as we saw in Feed Our Future, lunch ladies don't commit fraud. The fraud was happening when we outsourced the administration and then the provision. I don't know of, we have work to do on ensuring that Metro Mobility is what people need it to be, but we're not here talking about the county and Met Council administering fraud or administering a program. We're not talking about individual rides and fraud in that context. Or bus drivers is another good example. Like, there is a reason that when we talk about the public transportation systems, we often are not talking about fraud. And part of it is because we have designed the system so that the incentive structures that Representative Hudson is talking about are to provide the services that people ask for at the cost of providing those services plus the wages and benefits that people negotiate for and deserve under the law. And so I think we really have to get to yes, to all the individual things, and I'm glad to hear it. It felt like it was a little bit lost in this conversation, that one of the responses to the to what we have been seeing is bringing the administration of this benefit into one single state administrator. That feels like a good first step. That's at least we're not at least we're not outsourcing the oversight. But the question is, how do we change the incentive structure? I think we actually have to get, and that's probably the committee, whether it's transportation or whether it's HHS, but really start thinking about that. Otherwise, I worry we're going to be back here in 5 years, because what we've learned about these fraudsters in the public programs and, frankly, across our economy is they are innovative and they respond to the incentive structures we create. So let's just get them out of the program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Friedman. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has been a fascinating discussion this morning. And I first wanted to ask to the two of you at the table, the Deputy Commissioner and to Mr. Clark, I mean, you have a lot of experience with this even before you took this role with DHS as you were over at the Attorney General's office. Are the governor's recommendations, do they meet all of the things that the two of you would advocate for to protect the public's dollars?
Inspector General Clark.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, I think the governor's recommendations are important and will help. I mean, I think we're all aware there's no magic bullet solution, right, to these problems, but there's things that will help, right? I think one of the biggest things we can do as a state is better vetting of businesses and people on the front end, right? If folks pose too big a risk, if they have no history providing these services, have no financial capacity to provide these services, we should probably have better locks on our door and keep them from entering our programs. Either unserious businesses or would-be criminals, we just need to do a better job of keeping them out of the programs in the first place. The governor's proposal also gets into better managed care oversight. I think, as we're talking about now, that's very important. Managed care needs to step up its game. I mean, a lot of the fraud we've seen, housing stabilization services in the news, the Pit Stop 66 case that was prosecuted by the Attorney General's office with the fraud scheme, the transportation fraud scheme from Faribault up to the Twin Cities. A lot of that, the majority of that is happening in managed care, right? So we need to have better managed care oversight. So I think that's important. And then also the electronic visit verification for rides. I think that will help a lot for transportation trips.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Inspector General Clark. So thinking about this, when your office decided to designate this as high risk, was that based upon what was happening in managed care organizations or what's happening through state administration or overall? Tell me about that.
Inspector General Clark.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, it was across the board, right? It was across the board assessment. What were you seeing from managed care organizations? What was being referred to us? What was being prosecuted? Our own assessment of vulnerabilities in the programs. The situation that I'm seeing with transportation is that there's just no easy way to verify, right, that the trip was actually provided and that there was a corresponding medical appointment. When we were talking about a volume of 7 million claims for services in a year, right? Just knowing that there's that amount of volume, knowing that we've seen this amount of fraud in the news and being prosecuted, I think that informed our vulnerability assessment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a couple quick questions. Hopefully they're simple and easy for you, and I'm going to ask them quick so that you can hopefully answer quickly and move us along easily. So I'll just start with when I'm looking at what the governor's recommendations say, they say heightened surveillance and claims and claim scrutiny. So thinking about that, two initial questions here then would be, would the agency be willing to change the billing cycle from instead of annually to they have to have their claims in on a quarterly basis?
Inspector General.
Thank you, Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz. I'll defer to Deputy Commissioner Conley on billing questions.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, I think that's a great question, and I think we're open to conversation about that. There isn't, you know, a written in stone reason that a provider has a year to bill for claims, so I think we're open to ideas. And with respect to the governor's anti-fraud package, we think that every single one of the elements in there is a strong step forward. We think it's a robust package, but again, we don't have every single answer and are open to conversation about how we can build upon this effort.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I look at heightened surveillance, and that immediate next step for me goes right to GPS and cameras. And so I'm curious as to why that hasn't received the stamp of approval from you all yet.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Schultz, again, I think we're open to conversation about these ideas. And again, we think it's a very strong step forward and a strong package, but it doesn't contain every single answer that we could use to strengthen our anti-fraud efforts.
Mr. Schultz, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just going to be my final comment on this part. I think there are positives that are inside the governor's proposal. However, I just have to say that I believe that it feels like the administration kind of slows and then stops right before we have the opportunity to stop fraud. And I mentioned that, Madam Chair, because despite the fact that we have been operating from a perspective where GPS and cameras would be $30 a month per vehicle, or take an example, AI has been out there and available for great use to detect fraud for something like 18 months now or more. Just on Friday night, the Commissioner Gandhi on Almanac said that the whole agency isn't even using AI tools to help detect fraud. She said that on Friday night. I mean, that's pretty outrageous when you talk about the level of fraud we've seen in Minnesota and our ability to detect these things. I was shocked to hear that when she said that to a statewide audience.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. And to follow up on your comment about Inspector General, we had talked about this earlier as well, that we need to make sure that businesses have the financial capacity to be providers. So I dropped a bill this week, or maybe it was last week, where it will require that businesses who become enrolled for providing services through the state have to show 3 years of audited financials or 3 years of 990s. Would you support that?
Chair Robbins, I would need to see the text of the bill, but I am very much in support of enhanced vetting for providers. And I think a part of the problem, you know, with some of these providers that we're seeing committing fraud, they're just unserious, and we should have never let them in the door in the first place, right? And it makes my job very difficult to have to investigate this stuff, and I keep coming back to the fact that, like, why are we investigating? Why didn't we have better locks on our doors? So I think one thing is to look at financial capacity and also history of performing similar services.
I agree. I'll send you the language of the bill right after this hearing. Let's see. I have a couple more questions. We also talked, as Representative Greenman did, you mentioned that this bifurcation of responsibility is part of the problem. And we saw this when we had the hearing on assisted living facilities. So MDH has some oversight, DHS has some oversight, and MDH checks for health and safety, but they don't check for financials. When you guys do your inspection, you also, at least in assisted living, weren't checking on the financials. And in this case, Department of Transportation, who I've spoken with multiple times preparing for this hearing, they check to make sure the vehicle, you know, meets environmental standards and, you know, has a right odometer reading. And they don't, again, it appears that nobody's checking on the financials for these providers. So would you support taking all of that in-house for vetting these providers, or do you support keeping it between MnDOT and DHS?
Chair Robbins, I think that's a really good question. Again, we're certainly open to ideas about how we can strengthen provider credentialing within DHS and the activities that we do. We're also talking with CMS as a part of the conversations that are ongoing with them about that. With respect to transportation, though, because MnDOT has specialty kind of expertise in that area about vehicles and transportation, you know, we would want to defer to them on certain matters, but I think there's always room for tighter and better and stronger collaboration and communication between the agencies. We're absolutely open to that, but in areas where they have expertise where we don't, in terms of transportation, it may make sense because they have just a comparative kind of strength in that area for them to vet or to certify in ways that we wouldn't. But again, they should be coordinated.
Yes, and we should clarify who has responsibility for the financial oversight, because it seems to be a game of hot potato where MnDOT says it's not them. You guys say, oh, it's not you. That happened in the same hearing on the difference between MDH and DHS on assisted living. We have got to strengthen and have direct accountability for financial oversight in all of these programs. I had one more question. So we talked briefly about the Pit Stop 66 case, which there was a conviction earlier this month, a guilty plea. And I do want to thank the Attorney General's office and your former colleagues, Inspector General Clark, for their work on that. Previously, there had been a case involving a provider in Anoka who was doing the same thing, basically set up a practice for the purpose. I hope the public understands this. The practice in that Anoka case was set up for the purpose of getting maximum mileage. The recruiters said, leave your old practice, set up a new practice in Anoka, and we will funnel patients to you at the maximum 60-mile distance. That was the premise of why that business was set up. And there were convictions in that case as well. But unfortunately, the person who set up the practice, you know, is doing jail time. It doesn't appear that really anybody else is. One of the providers just got, community service, 50 hours of community service and 3 years of probation. And one of the pieces in that case and the Pit Stop case that we haven't really talked about are these provider logs. And so if we're going to do something on GPS, we need to make sure the interpretive services logs and the provider logs and the transportation logs are electronic so that we can make use of the data analytics. So I don't see anything in the governor's recommendations about electronic logs for all of those types of services, but we absolutely have to make that a priority. When they just submit written logs months later, the guy admitted to signing just stacks of blank logs. And he's not in jail. He got community service and he is still running his practice in Minneapolis. That is what the public gets furious about. There were no consequences for him signing stacks of false logs. So I want to know what your plan is to address the log situation. Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, appreciate that question. So, again, the electronic visit verification is an element of the governor's budget and anti-fraud package. And if you have other items that you're speaking to in terms of electronic verification or evidence of the trip provided, again, I think we're open to ideas. We think all the elements of the governor's package are strong steps forward, but we'll take a coalition of anybody who's interested in helping us fight fraud and strengthening our activity.
Thank you. I know Representative Pinto has a question, but I have one more. So most of these recommendations, if not all of them, were in the 2011 OLA report. This is not news. They talked about GPS. They talked about electronic logs. Like, why has DHS done none of that over the last umpteen years?
So Chair
Mr. Conley.
Yeah, Chair Robbins. Thank you. So my understanding of the history here, having been in the role for about 2 years and 5 months, is that there was, of course, the initial OLA report circa 2010, and then in the years following, there was the NEMT Advisory Committee that developed different responses to that. Many of the elements of their recommendations were then enacted in 2015 legislation. And then, of course, there was the step made last year in 2025 with respect to the single administrator and carving the benefit out of managed care. So that's my broad understanding of the evolution of how the different pieces of the OLA reports were digested, considered, and then eventually implemented. But again, if there are pieces of those things that didn't make it through that process and haven't been implemented, we're open to conversation about what makes sense, again, to strengthen program integrity.
We're having that conversation right now, and we want electronic records, we want electronic GPS tracking, we want cameras. That's what we need. We need to crack down on this. And I don't want to come back here in 5 years, as Representative Greenman said, and have this conversation again. This conversation has been going on for 15 years, and nothing has changed. So it is the time for action. Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a couple questions. One is just to what the Chair was just saying, those changes the Chair referenced, would those need to come through the legislature? Is that something the agency could do on its own, if you can tell us?
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto. So virtually all of these changes would need to occur via statute. So again, I think providers would be quick to point out, and it's good to hear that providers are supportive of many of these changes, that they have costs and those would need to be reflected in the rates. So we'd have to kind of work through both the rates piece of this and also the logistics of making sure all these things are in place and how we monitor them and state infrastructure to make sure, again, that all of these new sources of information are being monitored.
Okay.
Lead Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it does occur to me that as we identify changes in any of these programs that we think are appropriate, some of them the agency can initiate, but some of them the legislature would have to pass. We're all legislators. We should be introducing bills. We should be advancing them. A question I have, there was a comment made earlier about the use of AI for fraud detection within DHS. I recall the administration actually had an AI proposal last session that didn't advance. Can you just, I think you all were trying to have AI be part of fraud detection. Can you just talk about that?
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Lead Pinto, that's correct. There have been proposals with respect to AI from the administration, and I think we do want to use AI to the extent that it can help us strengthen what we do, but do it in ways, again, that ensure safety and protect civil rights, so to speak. So we want to make sure that we're doing it in very circumspect and thoughtful ways, and in ways that, again, have the intended outcomes and not other unintended outcomes.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair. And then can you talk about the impact? Obviously, the really big Medicaid news recently is the administration withholding, I think, $260 million in funding. Can you talk about the impact of that on this anti-fraud work and kind of what, and just more broadly, that have a major impact on our state, I would assume, if you can talk about that.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Lee Pinto, I appreciate this question very much. So what has essentially happened, and I'll try to be efficient here in my comments, but I just want to make sure everybody kind of understands what's happening. So the Vice President of the United States and the Administrator of CMS, Dr. Oz, communicated last week that they will begin deferring $260 million, roughly $259 million in change, starting with the fourth quarter of last federal fiscal year 2025, which means, in essence, we as a state will have to repay CMS that amount while they do a focused review of the 14 high-risk services that we identified. And I think both the Vice President and the Administrator communicated last week that they intend likely to do this over the course of several quarters, and we think that also is likely given how focused reviews typically transpire and how long they take. So we are already going through a separate focused review of the emergency Medicaid program, and that is taking several quarters, and typically, because of the volume of information that we have to provide to CMS, it just takes that long for us to pass through this process, and they will defer the funding, the federal funding, until they are satisfied with the outcome of the process or all of the information that we provided. This 14 service review, focus review, is much, much broader, like orders of magnitude broader and deeper than what we were doing with emergency Medicaid. So we anticipate this will go on for likely more than a year. And our deep concern is that there will be multiple deferrals of this size going forward throughout the subsequent quarters after the last quarter of federal fiscal year 25, which could amount to multiples of $260 million being deferred depending on the outcome of these focused reviews. And so to bring this to a conclusion, that really implicates the entire state budget. So if we're to lose, you know, $500 million, $1 billion, or have it deferred and then possibly later disallowed or some share of it disallowed, that's deeply alarming, I think, in terms of our ability to do any of this or to pay for the services that are in the program and the benefits that, you know, statute requires that we provide.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know we'll talk in other ways and means is meeting in this room after. We'll talk about the broader budget implications. But I gather you're talking about the implications specifically for providing services, but also for the oversight and fraud detection and anti-fraud work in the course of that as a result of this as well. I can see you nodding, which is obviously extremely concerning. So maybe just final comment is just that back to what I'd said before, that as we have a challenge in this committee, as we've said, that there's a separate Human Services Committee and state government, et cetera, but we're generating ideas in this committee. I guess I would encourage all of us, as we identify things that we think we should pursue, we have election certificates. If there's members that believe that they want to pursue those things, they should introduce those bills and have those conversations, as we have over a number of years. Obviously, there's some things within the control of the agency and less the legislature, and we're having a conversation about those as well. Thank you for your work, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Lead Pinto. And I encourage everyone to co-author my bill. That requires 3 months of financials or 3 years of financials, so I'll send the link around to everyone. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, as you were talking, just had a question as we think about Minnesota and this $259 million deferral. That is, as I understand what you're saying, is resources that we would have to take out of our general fund and give to the federal government that we've already paid. Is that correct?
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Greenman, for the fourth quarter of federal fiscal year 2025, that is the situation we're in. So going forward, they could do it again, which means we reduce it in terms of the amount we draw down from the federal government.
Representative Greenman.
So I think we've talked on this committee, and we just heard Representative, thank you, the Chair Robbins mention, you know, fraud in Missouri. We've seen it in Louisiana. We know Medicaid fraud is a problem that is a 50-state problem. I'm wondering if this this payment deferral, which I understand is quite unprecedented, if the Trump administration is doing this to any other of those states that are currently have fraud investigations in the Medicaid program.
Mr. Conley.
Chair Robbins, Representative Greenman, we've done a lot of homework on this to be sure of this, but we can pretty confidently say no, nothing of this scope, size, or nature.
And I would just remind everyone that Representative, former U.S. Attorney Andy Lugar said that Minnesota's level of fraud was unprecedented in the history of the country and far exceeding what he saw in other states. No, I just
Madam
to,
Chair, yes. Can I follow? Thank
yes,
you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think what we are seeing, and I have not heard from all the other 49 U.S. attorneys or former U.S. attorneys, but what we are seeing is if this administration and if my colleagues across the aisle are serious about this, I think we need, like we talk about AI and other things, we need to make sure that our programs, our agency, our Attorney General's office have the resources they need to both provide the services and also to do the things we're talking about, adding cameras to cars, adding additional level of oversight, hopefully restructuring the programs, and also increasing the investigation and the prosecution. All of those things take resources that right now the federal government is taking away from us. Additionally, we are seeing our partner in this, the AG's partner in this, the DHS's partner in this, the U.S. Attorney's Office has lost the attorneys that were doing all of the fraud work that you mentioned, both under former Attorney General Andy Lugar and the current former U.S. Attorney Andy Lugar and the current Attorney General. So I think that we have to, you know, none of us are responsible for making those decisions, but we are responsible for how our state responds to it and what we do about it. And if we are serious about having the resources both at the prosecutorial level, at the administration level, and at the oversight level to do this, you all and we need to be really serious about how, about this problem, the $260 million, and how that is going to get in the way of us doing everything we talked about here today. So I hope we can have some consensus on making sure that the federal government keeps up its end of the bargain as we talk about providing these services and doing them in a way that protects the taxpayer dollars. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. And I would just note for the record that the idea, which is one of the most low-hanging fruit of dealing with this, the GPS tracking in these cars, is something that would cost be borne by the provider as a cost of doing business. It would not be borne by the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. Okay, I know, Mr. Widener, you
That's
had...
Okay.
Mr. Weiner, you had wanted to jump in a couple times, and the conversation was flowing, so I didn't recognize you. Did you have some comments you wanted to add?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Chairwoman, excuse me. The issue that you just brought up, GPS and cameras, was in the task force committee, or the task force that we did. I was part of that. That DHS has shot that down every single time. I do not understand it. What I would recommend is it's about six words that need to be added to statute requiring GPS and cameras. That could be added to 256B. The other thing is, I don't think, this is just my positions, having been here and having had dealt with the state directly in paying claims prior to 2003, then the broker came in, then claims, then the rate, the usage and the claims paid and the money that went into this program has skyrocketed astronomically. I think the state could save some money, put off its single administrative, put that off, build DHS directly and institute cameras and GPS, and I think you'll be far ahead. There is a concern about whether you can really vet out this type of stuff. If you put in GPS, you don't have to vet it out. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Weidner. And to that point, when the task force, Mr. Connolly, made this recommendation back in, I believe, 2015, why was it not followed up on?
Chair Robbins, I'd have to go back and retrieve information about that for you.
Thank you. I would like to understand that, because it seems like this conversation is going on for a really long time, and it seems like it's the most obvious thing we could do. So with that, members, Vice Chair Anderson.
We're running out of time. So.
Okay. All right. So thank you to everyone for testifying. This was a very important conversation. Vice Chair Anderson, if you wouldn't mind taking the chair, I'm going to get to the presentation I ran out of time for last week.
Thank you. Chair Robbins.
Thank you, Vice Chair Anderson and members. I wanted to provide this presentation last week when we did the autism hearing and we just ran out of time. But it is still relevant to today's hearing because, as I have tried to show on multiple occasions in this committee, this is not an isolated thing with NEMT, with interpretive services, with the transportation providers today. But in the hearing we did last month, it was about the nexus between autism centers and assisted living providers and NEMT. A lot of the NEMT is with people taking kids to these centers that actually we found the rides are mostly fraudulent and the centers are mostly fraudulent. So NEMT touches the autism piece as well. And so I wanted to just flag this because I want the members and the public to understand that this is a web. And we keep finding these webs over and over. And I just feel like we are still missing the mark in our duty to dismantle these webs of fraud. So are we ready? Okay. So over the past couple of years, the autism centers, also known as the EIDBI providers, have received extensive media coverage following revelations that individuals connected to Feeding Our Future were also involved in autism centers. There was a large growth in EIDBI services since the benefit was created, and federal law enforcement began investigations into a dozen of those autism providers, resulting in the first charges in autism fraud last fall. And I just want to point out to you that earlier this month, the 79th defendant in Feeding Our Future was convicted, and she was the owner of one of these autism centers. But she previously in Feeding Our Future was the owner
of a child care center. And this is how it happens, members. This is the history of where we got to. The child care fraud back in like 2015, 2018 era, a lot of those people involved in the child care fraud then became autism feeding our future sites, and then they became autism providers. It's the same chain of people involved in this network of services. And this is what we saw just earlier this month. So, my friends, Fahima Mohammed owned and was convicted for fraud in the Future Leaders Early Learning Center. She was the 79th defendant to plead guilty or be convicted. She received hundreds of thousands of dollars for taxpayer meals she never provided to children. The Future Leaders Early Learning Center was flagged for DHS last year in this committee in February when we gave DHS a list of 72 problematic child care providers. They were number one on the list we provided in this committee last year, and they did nothing about it that we are aware of. So she continued.
Can I say to you, Madam Chair, just quickly, just a quick clarification, if I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto. Thank you,
Madam Chair, and Chair Robbins. Would you mind sending? Would you mind just maybe we can have staff just send to us that list where they were
happy
listed number
to
one.
Resend
thank
it.
You so much, Madam Chair. Appreciate
yes.
it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So continuing the trend we've seen with other fraudsters, Ms. Mohammed was involved in several other Medicaid-related companies. In addition to her child care center, she also has two assisted living facilities and is the owner of an autism center that is currently, to this day, enrolled to provide autism services. Members, this is a pattern we have seen over and over. Her child care center was shut down on February 10th of 2026, just a couple weeks ago. She was caught at the airport fleeing the country. That's how they arrested her. The next day, February 11th, a new child care center, hers was called Future Leaders Early Learning Center, a new child care center on February 11th opened on the same site called Leaders Child Care Center. And it is operating right now, getting paid by our taxpayers. I do not understand how that would be allowed by DHS. So a convicted person who shut down their child care was caught fleeing the country. A new child care center under a very similar name was allowed to reopen on that same spot the very next day. This was 2 weeks ago, members. I am so frustrated that this is happening on our watch despite dozens of hearings, despite dozens of witnesses. Members, this is so important, and I have to keep going because we are running out of time, but I just want to quick go to the next slide. So we have seen over and over the autism increases of units billed per year. We talked about in the hearing last month the number of providers and participants. It's off the charts. But this is not a new story, and that's why I want to get to this next one. This is something we have seen since the beginning of the child care scandal. So back in 2016, Kadra Hirsi was charged with CCAP fraud, so the child care fraud, for $300,000 in her fraud business through something called Ace Daycare in a building owned by the city of Eden Prairie. She was charged and convicted, and that daycare was shut down. But she transferred the lease, just like we just talked about, happened here a week or so ago, to Daycare One and to Person One. And Person One tried to open Daycare One the very next day at the same location. Sound familiar? And Daycare One then received media coverage about problematic things going on at that daycare. And so the city of Eden Prairie got involved and shut that down and revoked the license for the new daycare that was trying to open on the site. They just didn't want to have a building owned by the city continue to have this problem. But then Person Two got involved and tried to open Daycare Two at the same site. And again, the city stepped in and said no, and Daycare Two didn't actually open. But Person One and Person Two were not to be deterred in finding ways to get involved in daycare or in all these programs. So Person Two opened Assisted Living One and Assisted Living Two, and they are still operating. And Person One opened
HCBS 1 and HCBS 2, and an autism center, all currently functioning, billing the state more than $1 million. Members, this has been going on since 2016, and we see layer after layer after layer. And I know I'm out of time, and I apologize, Vice Chair Anderson, but these webs are so important for our members and our public to understand. This is not new. This has been going on and has been ignored repeatedly, and I'm begging us to stop ignoring it and pay attention. Vice Chair Anderson, thank you.
Thank you. We have 1 minute.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Madam Chair, will there be? I know we're at time now. But this is the second time we've had a chair presentation and haven't just I know because of time haven't had a chance to ask questions. I wonder, Chair Robbins, if will you budget some time at a future hearing to ask questions about your two presentations? We just haven't had a chance to ask questions. I got all kinds of things.
Yes, I would love to. And maybe we should do one hearing just on these webs because, honestly, I have like three more I could do presentations on. We just keep running out of time because we also have to talk about these programs and the bills that are coming forward. So we will find a time.
Thank you. And before we adjourn, Lead Pinto, as soon as we get the governor's, I don't even know who the author is in some of these, but I think it's important that let us know. And I know there's some things that maybe need to be added, and there's some of them are good. So, yeah. All right, members, we are adjourned. So, thank you.